Welcome to this week's Ox Talk for Tuesday the 28th of July 2026. This week's news items from the local papers were selected by Diane Sider and Freya Tolkinson and read by Judith Pickett and David Field. This week's edition was compiled by me, David Field, and the copying and the distribution of the USB sticks is by Michelle Lawful. Today sunrise is at 5:20 in the morning and sunset at 9 p.m. On this day, in 1794, the French revolutionary figure Robespierre and 22 other leaders of the Terror went to the guillotine in Paris. In 1914, Austria-Hungary decides against mediation and declares war on Serbia, the first declaration of war of World War I. In 1943, the RAF bombing over Hamburg causes a firestorm that kills over 40,000 German civilians. And in 2005, the Provisional IRA ends its 30-year-long armed campaign in Northern Ireland. Birthdays on this day: Beatrix Potter, 1866, Garfield Sobers, 1936, and Harry Kane. And died on this day: Thomas Cromwell in 1540, and J.S. Bach in 1750, with Vivaldi 9 years ahead of him on the same day. Before the news, we have some poems from Jenny, well suited to the current weather.
As we are all experiencing record-breaking temperatures, it seemed appropriate to share a collection of poems on the subject of heat waves. My first poem is entitled Burning Alive. It's too hot, I can't stand this heat. The pavement's on fire, it's burning my feet. The sun is relentless, never seeming to yield. Skin is so burnt, needing to be peeled. Under the shade tree I try to huddle, getting out of the sun before I'm a puddle. It doesn't matter how much I drink, eyes are so dry I can't even blink. I must find a place where I can get cool, so I don't start acting like a fool. The weather will break, the heat will subside. It sure has been one hot, steamy ride. Sun scorches with searing beat, wilting wildlife in burning heat, fiery flames of solar flare, and barely a breath in the arid air. The hot weather often brings out the lighter side of life. The scorching sun, oppressive heat, and the inevitable longing for cooler days can inspire humour as much as frustration. So here are a few excerpts from six various poems. The air is thick as melted cheese. A summer storm is sure to tease. The sun is high, the sweat is free. I wish the wind would come to me. The heat's a fire in the sky, it makes the trees and people cry. I'd leap in water if I could, but all the lakes have dried for good. It's hotter than a baking pie, the sun is hanging way up high. The sidewalk sizzles, the grass is fried. I wish I could just crawl inside. I'm too hot to play, too hot to run, too hot to think, too hot for fun. I'll sit here in the shade if I can, but I'm sure the shade is getting tan. The heat is fierce, the sky is wide, the sun, a furnace, burns the tide. I seek the shade, but it's too late, the trees are charred, the ground is baked. The sun is burning high and bright. My skin is burning day and night. I dream of rain, I dream of snow, but summer's heat won't let me go. But there will be a respite and we will have time to reflect, as expressed in the choice of my final two poems, both entitled Heat Waves. The heat wave has burned the garden. No amount of watering can quench its thirst. finally, the rain comes, cool and sweet, the air pungent with rebirth, and standing in the flowers, sharing their joys, my cotton dress drenched as it clings like a skin to my body, hair wet, sticking to my shoulders as my face looks to the sky like a human sunflower. The news you're coming home washes the heat from my body, renewing me like a flower. I shall bloom for you on our reunion. And then finally, no doubt we'll look back, muffled up, heaters on full blast, and we'll be unable to believe that heat, this fierce, in-your-face, uncompromising, unblemished sunshine, this August drought, rivers drying up, shallows where lakes should be, shriveled yellow lawns. No doubt it will go down in the, do you remember that summer month, when every day was hot as hell, file in our collective memories, days like today, when we wear as little as we can get away with and stay decent. Days to keep doors open and curtains closed. Days to drink ice water instead of rosé wine.
Piano lovers are in for a spectacular celebration of music this summer. The 27th Oxford Piano Festival returns from July the 25th to August the 2nd, promising a dynamic blend of concerts, masterclasses and workshops led by world-class musicians. Esteemed pianists Paul Lewis, Isata Kane-Mason, Ingrid Fleiter and Elizabeth Leonskaya are set to headline the recitals, performing works by composers including Beethoven, Chopin, Schubert and Rachmaninoff. Marius Papadopoulos, founder and artistic director of the Oxford Piano Festival, said, "The programme in this year's festival features works in the piano literature that are rich in conveying the power of music and its ability to speak to us all through the instrument. No less than 7 internationally renowned pianists, each with a very distinctive voice, will be exploring music of various styles and periods. In addition to evening performances, the festival will offer masterclasses with leading pianists including Catherine Stott, Vanessa Latache and Stephen Kovacevich. Tickets for the recital start from £12. For more information or to purchase tickets, call the Oxford Philharmonic Orchestra box office on 01865 980 980, that's 01865 980 980, or you can visit oxfordpianofestival.com, that's all one word, Oxford Piano Festival.
The government has decided to abolish Oxfordshire's existing councils. This decision, part of a national move to replace all remaining two-tier county stroke district arrangements with unitary councils, affects more than 130 councils across 14 areas of England. Oxford City Council has welcomed the changes, stating it will shape the future of Oxford, Oxfordshire and West Berkshire for generations. Currently, Oxfordshire has a county council and 5 smaller district or city councils: Oxford City Council, Charwell District Council, South Oxfordshire District Council, Vale of Whitehorse District Council and West Oxfordshire District Council. These 6 main councils will now be replaced with 3 new councils: Greater Oxford Council, Northern Oxfordshire Council and Ridgeway Council. Town and parish councils will remain. Greater Oxford Council will cover the areas previously managed by Oxford City Council and parts of Charwell, South Oxfordshire and the Vale of Whitehorse districts. Northern Oxfordshire will encompass what was West Oxfordshire District Council and the remaining parts of Charwell. Ridgeway Council will cover most of South Oxfordshire and Vale of Whitehorse districts, plus West Berkshire. Under this controversial plan, here are the places that will be moved into Greater Oxford Council area in 2028. In South Oxfordshire, Beckley and Stowood, Berinsfield, Clifton Hampden, Cuddeston and Denton, Culham, Dorchester, Drayton St Leonard, Elsfield and Forest Hill with Shotover will all form part of Greater Oxford. Garsington, Great Milton, Holton, Horsepath, Little Milton, Marsh Bolden, Newnham Courtney, Sandford, Stadhampton, Stanton St John, Toot Balden, Warborough, Waterperry and Tom with Tomley, Waterstock, Wheatley and Woodeaton will also be joining them. Meanwhile, in the Vale, Appleton with Eton, Besley, Cumnor, Kennington, North Hinksey with Botley, South Hinksey, Sunningwell, Wootton, Whiteham will all form part of the Greater Oxford. In Charwell District, the newly prescribed town of Kidlington will land in Greater Oxford, as will Yarnton, Thrupp, Islip, Wesson-on-the-Green, Wendelbury, Oddington, Bletchington, Charlton-on-Otmore and Noke. Amongst the many critics, Callum Miller, MP for Bicester and Woodstock, said, "I'm flabbergasted that Kidlington and many villages will be ripped out of Charwell and swallowed into Greater Oxford authority without the consent of local people. They will lose their district voice and their physical separation, with decisions instead taken by a council dominated by the city and the erosion of the Greenbelt." However, City Council Cabinet Member for Housing, Linda Smith, said the villages to be in Greater Oxford all fall within the orbit of the city. She said, "Nearby communities like Botley, Kidlington and Wheatley fall naturally within the orbit of the city. They are part of our local economy. They look to the city for jobs, transport, shopping and leisure activities. Oxford, together with its surrounding villages, will be even greater than it is now. This decision lays the right foundation for economic growth, sustainable communities with more affordable homes and better public transport, and simplified council services for all residents."
A homegrown Oxford punk band, an outfit of over 50s women, has released two debut singles soon after its three-year anniversary. The Hormones is an all-women feminist punk band formed in Oxford in March 23, who have grown to great acclaim for their vibrant gigs from enthusiastic fans. The group, made up of 9 women, aged from 52 to 79, were all novices when they first picked up their instruments 3 years ago, but won crowds over through unapologetic live performances, presenting a mixture of humour and anger which speaks to the core of punk. They announced the release of their debut singles to all platforms recently. Fans will now be able to sing along to Sandwiches and Dance to Dirty in their own homes, the first of the music from the band set to drop this year. After gigging for the first time in June 23, the group are now heading for spots on the stages of Bunkfest in Wallingford this September, Binsey Fair, Club K and the Bullingdon.
A plea to Donald Trump is planned amid an Oxfordshire village independence vote. The chair of Piddington Parish Council has said that if the village votes to leave the United Kingdom, he will present their Declaration of Independence to the US Embassy in the hope of obtaining their support. Recently, residents of Piddington overwhelmingly voted in favour of holding a referendum on remaining within the United Kingdom, with the poll set to happen soon. The initial vote was held on Saturday the 4th of July to coincide with the 250th anniversary of American independence, with 96% of the village saying they wanted to see plans for the referendum move forward. This comes after the government announced that it was looking to use the redundant Ministry of Defence site located at Site A of the Bicester Garrison between Piddington and Upper Arncott to house male asylum seekers. It could be operational as early as the end of 2026, with Callum Miller, MP for Bicester and Woodstock, saying 1,200 men could be placed in the facility which borders the local playing field. It has sparked outrage, with hundreds protesting against it, and Piddington now threatening to leave the country. Tim McNally, chair of Piddington Parish Council, said, "It's about representation. We have had no input into the proposal. We have been asking questions and nothing has come back." He added, "The shock of the information triggered people. I could have prepared them if I was given prior warning." The referendum on independence is currently being planned, with a date for the historic vote not yet set. However, designs are already in place in case the village does decide to break away from the UK, with a constitution already being worked up. "I'm exploring all the avenues," said Mr. McNally, adding, "If we do vote to leave, we're going to go down to the US Embassy and bring our declaration to them." The 60-year-old continued, "We want the American Embassy to support us in our plight." Indeed, he compared their situation to the American revolutionaries and his own role to that of George Washington's during the 18th century war. He said, "George Washington brought a change about. I am going to make the change and then give away the power like he did." The Home Office has refused to comment on the referendum, including whether they would honour any result.
A new Ebola vaccine developed by Oxford scientists has been administered to humans for the first time. The vaccine, named CHADOX1-PDBV, marks a key milestone for the project. The vaccine was created by the University of Oxford's Oxford Vaccine Group and Pandemic Sciences Institute, using the same technology as the Oxford AstraZeneca COVID-19 vaccine. The first volunteer in the world, a 37-year-old UK man called Ed Hunt, has received the experimental vaccine against Ebola. Hunt said he wanted to help after seeing news reports of the outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo. The clinical trial is funded as part of an $8.6 million program with the University of Oxford to push forward Bundibugyo vaccine development. The trial, which will continue to recruit and vaccinate volunteers over the next few weeks, will monitor participants to evaluate both the safety and immune responses elicited by the vaccine. Dr. David Pulido Gomez, Global Chemistry, Manufacturing and Controls Lead, Pandemic Sciences Institute, Nuffield Department of Medicine, that's a mouthful, highlighted the speed of the vaccine's development. He said, "Reaching this milestone in such a short time frame reflects an extraordinary collaborative effort." Dr. Peter Skidmore, lead study doctor for the BDEBOV trial at the Oxford Vaccine Group, said, "Vaccinating the first participants in a first in-human study is always a significant moment. While these are very early days, they represent an important first step in evaluating this vaccine in humans. Eligible participants aged 18 to 55 years, in good health and able to attend regular face-to-face visits in Oxford, will receive either one dose or two doses of the vaccine, depending on group allocation." The trial follows the World Health Organization's declaration of a public health emergency of international concern after cases of severe fever and death were detected in the Democratic Republic of Congo on May 17, 2026. The outbreak continues to spread rapidly, with at least 80% of new cases emerging from unknown chains of transmission, according to the World Health Organization. Many of the newly reported deaths are people who died in their communities without reaching a health facility and without receiving care. Dr. Chikwe Ihekwiazu, the WHO Health Emergency Chief, said, "After returning from Bunia in Ituri, the worst-hit province in the outbreak, the Bundibugyo virus is primarily carried by fruit bats and can cross over into humans through contact with infected animals. Once this occurs, it can then spread from person to person through direct contact with infected body fluids."
An Oxfordshire tip will not close for 3 months this summer as planned. The temporary closure of Redbridge Household Waste Recycling Centre in Oxford has been pushed back until early 2027. It was initially planned to close this season for unavoidable safety works and ground stabilisation. The essential maintenance requires installing corrugated steel sheet piling along the east and west site embankments, as well as concrete repairs. It now won't be closing this summer, and the council says early 2027 is looking more likely. No explanation was given for the postponed closure.
Residents have expressed their concerns that an Oxford neighbourhood is set to be cut off from the city by a 56-week-long footpath closure. Signs went up on paths through Grand Pont Nature Park and Oxpens Meadow on Tuesday, July the 22nd, that several well-used footpaths would be closing for up to 56 weeks from as soon as next week. Oxford City Council confirmed the paths would be shut to enable works to install Oxpens River Bridge, the controversial new walking and cycling route over the Thames designed to connect the south and west of Oxford with the city centre. Canon Dr. Chris Sugden, 78, said he and his wife, Dr. Elaine Sugden, a retired oncology consultant, use the path regularly and are concerned about the disruption its closure will cause. Dr. Sugden said, "This is the only path from here to the centre of Oxford that avoids the Botley Road closure. That route will become unusable. It's cutting off a section of residents who will just clog up either with their cars because they'll then have to drive, or the narrow one-lane footpath along the Botley Road. Why not wait until the Botley Road is open and then close the footpath? That's our point. It's just not joined-up thinking." Oxford City Council said that while the council recognises residents often use the pathways as an alternative to the Botley Road closure, waiting until the road reopens would delay the Oxpens Bridge project. This would delay the closure of the Oxpens Meadow and add risk by requiring more of the bridge works to be carried out during the flooding season. Network Rail also just announced the Botley Road would remain closed for an additional 6 weeks after its expected reopening at the end of August. The footpath through Oxpens Meadow will be closed from Wednesday the 20th of July, and the footpath through Grand Pont Nature Park, including the path between the Gasworks Rail Bridge and White House Lane, would be shut on or soon after Monday, August the 3rd. Both paths are expected to reopen when the bridge construction is completed, anticipated as spring 2027. But the temporary traffic regulation order, approved by the County Council, means it could be shut for as long as 56 weeks. Dr. Sugden added that on a single journey into the city using the footpath earlier this week, there must have passed 100 people walking or cycling along the thoroughfare. Councillor Anna Railton, Deputy Leader and Cabinet Member for Planning and Zero Carbon Oxford, said, "This is an important next step in the journey of Oxpens River Bridge and for creating a sustainable transport network in Oxford. We appreciate that these two footpaths are currently used as an alternative during the closure of Botley Road, and this will cause some further inconvenience to users. However, it is important that we stick to the timetable of this vital project for Oxford. We appreciate the patience of local residents during this stage and encourage them to make themselves familiar with the two alternative routes that are available."
Journalist Emma Brennan recalls when few people went abroad for their summer break and staycation was the only option. "This time of year always fills me with joyous memories of looking forward to our annual summer holiday. It was nothing lavish by today's standards, just a week away somewhere on the British coast. These days, remaining in this country is often referred to as a staycation. But to us kids in the 1970s, that was the only holiday option. At that time, relatively few people went abroad, and if they did, it was usually Spain or somewhere close. I don't recall any of my school friends going to Disneyland, for example. The vast majority stayed in British seaside resorts, and instead of an all-inclusive package holiday to Tenerife, opted for the homegrown equivalent, a holiday camp. These offered organised family entertainment, along with the food and accommodation. There was little need to venture off camp, with everything you required on site. A far cry from the globe-trotting holidays many aspire to these days. I always remember being mighty impressed when my school friend told me she was going on holiday to California. It seemed beyond possibility that you could get on a plane and jet off to America for holiday. I was thinking palm trees, sun-drenched beaches, and surfable waves. I was suitably deflated to discover she was actually going to California Sands, a holiday camp on the East Anglian coast. This is because holiday camps were never really my thing, probably not helped by the iconic 1980s British sitcom, Heidi High, which was set in a fictional Maplin's holiday camp in 1959 and 1960. As creative kids with good imaginations, we didn't much fancy regimented activities, so the nearest we got to a holiday camp was a week in a very basic seaside chalet park with a clubhouse for entertainment. Nonetheless, plenty of people have a real fondness for holiday camps, which have long and enduring history in Britain. The first, Cunningham's Camp, was established in 1894 on the Isle of Man. Accommodation was in tents, and the stay included basic outdoor activities. By 1939, more than 300 holiday camps had been founded across the UK, ranging from 50 to 6,000 bed sites, mostly in huts or chalets. Probably the best known was Butlin's, founded by William Billy Butlin in 1936 in Skegness. The main British rival was Pontins, established after the Second World War in 1946. From the end of the war through the 1950s and 60s, many smaller local holiday camps popped up, cashing in on what had become a thriving industry. Entertainment was led by multi-talented staff, instantly recognisable by the colour of their blazers. Butlin's was famous for its red coats and Pontins for its blue coats. Being a holiday camp entertainer ignited the careers of many a future star, such as Jimmy Tarbuck, Bradley Walsh and Shane Ritchie. These days, holiday camps have evolved into more sophisticated parks, with luxury lodges, caravans and even yurts, vastly different to the basic tented accommodation of Cunningham's day. There was no such thing as glamping in those days. High-end versions such as Centre Parks offer a highly modernised incarnation of the old-style holiday camps, with cosy cabins, tree houses nestled in the woodland setting, and multiple outdoor activities for the adventurous.
The Dominican Friars of Oxford are set to open a new city centre cafe and bakery this summer in a former city centre bank. Blackfriars Priory is opening a cafe called The Good Habit in St Giles, with works on the site nearing completion. Planning permission was secured by the Roman Catholic Religious Order earlier this year, and the final permission to display signage and install a canopy with cafe branding on it is currently under consideration. Releasing an update on social media, filmed at the site under construction earlier in the summer, Regent of Blackfriars Priory, Father John O'Connor, said, "At long last, we have planning permission, we have the workers on site, and things are moving really quickly, with a view to an opening during the summer. It's a great project. It's going to be a real retail cafe during the day, buzzing with lots of activity, and then in the evening there'll be opportunities for Blackfriars Hall events, events for the community, and also events for the wider public as well, in what I think is a wonderful part of Oxford that is buzzing in so many different ways." The unit at 33 St Giles was previously a bank up to 2018, but will now be turned into a stylish cafe and event space, billing itself as a spot for coffee and bakery on the signage. Manager of the new cafe, Rich Sewell, said, "I'm really looking forward to opening Good Habit this summer. I've been working with Blackfriars now for the last couple of years, and it's really great to see how this project has been developing. I'm looking forward to bringing this to Oxford. It'll be a great cafe and a great space for everybody, the public and for Blackfriars students, to enjoy."
New dinosaur exhibits are coming to the Oxford University Museum of Natural History. Timed to coincide with the completion of the museum's largest redisplay project in its 165-year history, the new display opens to the public on Monday, 20th of July. They feature three long-lost creatures from Oxfordshire, including the world's first named dinosaur, Megalosaurus. Dr. Gavin Svensson, director of the Museum of Natural History, said, "Life as we know it has been a long-term effort to rethink how we present the natural world to our visitors, and it's a pleasure to see that vision now fully realised. The new displays bring together thousands of specimens to tell some of the most important stories in science, from the history of life on Earth to the extraordinary diversity of the natural world today. We hope they will inspire curiosity, encourage discovery, and help visitors of all ages see their place within the wider story of our planet." The Megalosaurus was discovered in Stonesfield in the late 18th century and was named in 1824 after analysis by Oxford professor William Buckland. Visitors will be able to view its fossil remains, including the famous lower jawbone, as part of the museum's new prehistoric ecosystem displays, supported by Biffa Award. The final phase of Life as We Know It project also features Eustreptospondylus, a predatory dinosaur unearthed in Summertown in 1870. This specimen will be displayed for the first time as a fully articulated skeleton, developed through collaboration with the University of Chicago using a mix of fossil material, digital modelling and 3D printing. The third dinosaur, Cumnoria, discovered in Cumnor in 1879, will also feature in the fossilisation showcase. In total, the project includes 48 new displays within 24 modern cases, covering themes such as biodiversity, ecosystems and evolution. Interactive elements include touching mineral specimens and Prehistoric Diver, a digital experience that lets visitors explore ancient oceans ecosystems aboard a virtual submarine.
Botley Road's delayed reopening is another kick in the teeth, with people at breaking point, a council leader has said. Vale of Wight Horse Chief Bethia Thomas will now write to Network Rail over the delayed reopening, which could now be as late as mid-October. Work started at Oxford Railway Station in April 2023, and the date to finish has consistently been pushed back by Network Rail. As Thomas said, she is deeply disappointed with Network Rail's latest revelation that it will yet again fail to fulfil its promises about Botley Road. To have the long-promised opening so close and then to have it snatched away again, like so many times before over the last 2 years, it's utterly unacceptable, she said. It's a further kick in the teeth to hear the horrendous disruption could go on for another 6 weeks. This is beyond frustrating for so many of our residents. Access to vital services in Oxford has become a significant challenge for many in the Vale, particularly our residents and business owners in Botley and the A420 corridor. Many people have experienced a significant negative impact on their daily lives, with simple, usually short journeys to work or school now taking hours, with the hardest hit being those with mobility issues. Network Rail has yet again managed this project poorly, heaping more misery on local people, particularly affecting them in the run-up to holiday periods. Unexpected things happen in any project, and we do appreciate public safety has to remain the top priority. However, delays have become the norm in this project, and our patience has been stretched to breaking point. Although the District Council has no direct involvement or influence in this project, we will continue to maintain pressure on Network Rail to ensure that the work is completed as swiftly as possible and prevent any more unacceptable delays. I will be writing to Network Rail this week. There are serious questions that need answering and the management of the whole project that needs to be addressed.
A secret message hidden on the side of a Great Western Railway train for the past 4 years has finally been deciphered. The train was concealed within Train Bow Intercity Express Train 800008, named in honour of World War II codebreaker Alan Turing, back in May 2022. The hidden message read, "Now know ye that we, in consideration of circumstances, humbly represented unto us, are graciously pleased to extend our grace and mercy unto the said Alan Matheson Turing, and grant him our free pardon posthumously in respect of the said convictions." The wording was taken from the official royal prerogative of mercy, granted to Alan Turing by Her Late Majesty Queen Elizabeth II, recognising the injustice of his conviction under laws that criminalised homosexuality. Turing's law was subsequently passed in 2017 and led to pardons for thousands of other men criminalised for same-sex relationships. GWR launched its competition ahead of the anniversary of Turing's birthday on the 23rd of June, revealing three clues before 24 super sleuths were successfully able to decipher the hidden message. Best known for his work at Bletchley Park during the Second World War, Turing led the team responsible for breaking the German Naval Enigma Code, intelligence work that proved crucial to the Allied war effort. The train was named by members of Turing's family at London Paddington. John Carter, Great Western Railway. Oxfordshire police officers deserve better than warm words and broken promises, as it is announced that they will get a pay rise. Thames Valley Police Federation has said that 3.5% uplift from September is a pay rise in name only. Chair of the Federation, Aileen O'Connor, accused the government of ignoring the recommendation of the Independent Police Remuneration Review Body that officers should get 3.9%. Ms. O'Connor said, "Police officers across Thames Valley will be frustrated and disappointed by this year's pay award. And personally, as chair of their federation, I am extremely angry on their behalf." She added, "You cannot praise police officers as indispensable one minute and ignore independent recommendations on their pay the next. After years of real-term pay erosion, many officers will see this as a pay rise in name only. At a time when policing faces ongoing challenges in recruitment, retention and morale, this decision risks sending the wrong message to those who serve their communities every day. Police officers deserve better than warm words and broken promises. They deserve fair pay that reflects the job they do and the sacrifices they make every day." Home Secretary Shabana Mahmood chose a lower figure for officers across England and Wales, which includes around 4,700 employed by Thames Valley Police. "This is the highest award that is manageable within existing police force and Home Office budgets, while enabling the continued delivery of the government's crime and policing priorities," she said in a written statement. Meanwhile, MPs' basic salary rose 5% to £98,599 a year in April, and resident doctors are understood to be negotiating a potential 6.6% pay uplift. However, in a very different news item, Thames Valley Police joined forces with a Royal Navy Sea Scout group for teamwork building. The first Stanlake and Cokethorpe Sea Scouts near Whitney, one of only 103 Sea Scout groups, taught Thames Valley Police how to build and launch rafts. A spokesperson for Thames Valley Police said, "A massive thank you to the first Stanlake and Cokethorpe Sea Scouts for inviting our team to your fantastic challenge evening. We had a brilliant time getting involved, meeting everyone and putting our teamwork skills to the test. One of the highlights was helping to build and launch rafts, although it's fair to say our engineering skills might need a little more work. Luckily, there was plenty of laughter, great sportsmanship and memorable moments along the way. Thank you to all the scouts and leaders for making us feel so welcome. We thoroughly enjoyed being part of such a fun and inspiring evening and can't wait to see you all again soon."
It has been a year since Oxford University student and Harry Potter star Emma Watson was tipped to be the next Bond girl in the James Bond film franchise. The Hollywood actress is well known for her iconic role as Hermione Granger in all eight of the Wizarding World's films. After turning her attention to studies, she opted to study a master's degree in creative writing at the University of Oxford in September 23. It was announced in February last year that Miss Watson had switched to a DPhil, which is Oxford's version of a PhD. Before that, Miss Watson had attended the Dragon School, as well as the Headington School, where she studied for her GCSEs and A-levels. Despite still studying at Oxford currently, the actress was tipped to be the next Bond girl in the James Bond film franchise. Most recently played by Daniel Craig in 2021's No Time to Die, the titular spy is set to be cast soon, with Aaron Taylor-Johnson and Oxford's Theo James among the favourites. Denis Villeneuve has already been officially chosen to direct the next 007 movie after previous hits including Arrival, Blade Runner 2049, Sicario, Prisoners, and Dune, and Dune Part 2. Rumours have started to spread as to who may be joining the main character as a potential love interest, and Miss Watson has emerged among the frontrunners. A report in The Standard last July said, "The actress has shifted her focus to activism since then, saying in 2020 that she was curious to embrace a role where she works to amplify more voices, to continue to learn from those with different experiences. With odds of 2-1, this could mark Watson's return to the screen."
The county must halt its transport plans and not ram through measures before its abolition, local businesses have implored. There have been calls for Oxfordshire County Council to hold off its plans for traffic filters rollout, the zero emissions zone rollout, and the workplace parking levy, as confirmation of local government reorganisation will see the authority abolished in April 2028. Filters are set to come into force on September the 14th, replacing the controversial congestion charge, despite furious pleas from independent businesses. After the dissolution of the county, city and district councils, New Northern Oxfordshire, Greater Oxford and Ridgeway councils will take on the county's transport powers. These could be usurped in the future by wider Thames Valley devolution, but talks on this have stalled. Restaurateur and spokesperson for Oxford Business Action Group, OBAG, Bernadette Evans said, "Oxfordshire County Council should focus on making the transition to the new Greater Oxford Council as painless as possible for high street businesses, not treat the forthcoming changes as an excuse to ram through as many anti-business measures as possible. We're calling on them to halt all work on traffic filters rollout, the zero emissions zone rollout, and the workplace parking levy. Susan Brown, the current Labour leader of Oxford City Council, which will also be abolished in April 2028, said her party will have to consider its policy on traffic filters moving into elections for the new authorities. She said, "You'll have to see what we put in the manifesto, because that's something we'll have to talk about and consider." Ludwigstar David Mitchell has paid tribute to Oxford's Inspector Morse detective series, saying it reminds him of home. He is now appearing in the BBC drama Ludwig as John Ludwig Taylor, a reclusive puzzle designer who assumes the identity of his twin brother, a detective chief inspector, after he goes missing. The hit series also features Motherland's Anna Maxwell Martin, with Fleabag star Sian Clifford and Scottish actor Mark Bonar joining the cast as regulars in the second series, which is due to be broadcast in August, with a third series already commissioned. The detective drama set in Cambridge is one of the BBC's most successful in terms of viewing figures for many years. Now it has emerged that Mr. Mitchell, who grew up in Oxford and went to Abingdon School before attending Cambridge University, was a big fan of Inspector Morse, the iconic ITV detective series based on the novels of Oxford's Colin Dexter and starring John Thor and Kevin Whateley. Inspector Morse episodes ran for 13 years between 1987 and 2000. And was followed by the Lewis and Endeavour series. Endeavour, starring Sean Evans as a young Morse, ran from 2012 until 2023, and the last ever episode concluded the Colin Dexter's TV franchise. Mr. Mitchell said that the Inspector Morse theme tune, created by composer Barrington Furlong, reminded him of home. He said, "I grew up in Oxford in the heyday of Inspector Morse, and we'd all sit down and watch it together on a Wednesday night. It's not very creative of me. It's the theme tune of a programme set in my hometown. It's only particularly special because they were actually making it at the time, and I was living there as a child and teenager. In those days, television was the mightiest medium of anything that had ever existed. So we all felt very important that there was this hit show on ITV that was all filmed where we lived." The first season of Ludwig attracted more than 9.5 million viewers in 28 days and became the BBC's biggest scripted series since 2024 and the biggest comedy launch episode since at least 2018. The highly anticipated second series will pick up from the end of season one, with Mitchell's character, John, now employed as a crime scene consultant for the Cambridge Police Authority. The second series is expected to be shown in August. John's identical twin brother, James, remains missing, but the consultant has been banned from using any police resources to look for his sibling or uncover exactly what he was investigating. But John will not stop, and neither will Maxwell Martin's character, Lucy Betts Taylor, who is the wife of the missing brother, James.
The government's new health secretary has vowed to improve maternity services, including those at the John Radcliffe. Oxford-educated Yvette Cooper was appointed to the role by new Labour Prime Minister Andy Burnham on Monday, July the 20th. In her first speech accepting the role, the 57-year-old vowed to urgently improve maternity services. It comes as the John Radcliffe was recently scolded in a national and independent review carried out by Baroness Amos. As Cooper said, "I'm looking forward to working urgently to improve maternity services, take forward plans for social care, and to once again play a part in supporting our National Health Service, Labour's proudest achievement. Most of all, I'm looking forward to working with the dedicated NHS staff, carers, healthcare professionals and volunteers on whom we all depend. In leaving the Foreign Office, let me pay tribute to the brilliant diplomats and ministers I worked with at the Foreign Office, and to my fellow foreign ministers from across the world, for all the work we did together to support Ukraine, to recognise the state of Palestine, to keep the spotlight on Sudan, and to treat violence against women and girls as the global crisis it is. Women not listened to, staff close to burnout, and a culture of "that's the Oxford way" are just some of the concerns raised in the landmark review of maternity services in Oxfordshire. Baroness Amos's investigation found one consistent message from families who spoke that they were not listened to or taken seriously when raising concerns about their own health or their baby's condition. Another recurring theme was the apparent lack of consistent support following harm or loss, it found. While bereavement teams were praised, supportive care was not consistently experienced by families across other parts of the service. The report added, families told us about not being listened to at OUH and felt that the hospital prioritised doing things the Oxford way over their care preferences. However, we also heard women who had positive experiences and spoke highly of individual midwives and services such as the midwife-led unit, the Spires. One clinical staff member told the investigation, anything that is done in Oxford by Oxford that potentially isn't done anywhere else in the world is the Oxford way. It is the best. Woe betide you if you challenge it. Simon Crowther, interim chief executive of Oxford University Hospitals Trust, said he is deeply sorry for the harm, distress and loss experienced by some mothers and families. We will place the experiences shared with Baroness Amos and her team at the heart of our improvement plans, he added.
Beer once brewed in Abingdon will be brewed in Bedford from next year. In a surprise move, the old Speckled Hen brands that originated at Moreland Brewery in Abingdon have been sold by Green King to Dam UK, the British arm of Barcelona-based independent family brewer S.A. Dam and Estrella Dam fame. Old Speckled Hen and its spin-off brands Old Golden Hen, Old Crafty Hen, Old Master Hen and low-alcohol Old Speckled Hen will continue to be brewed by GK at Bury St. Edmunds until June next year. Then they will move to Eagle Brewery in Bedford, where Dam operates the former Charles Wells Brewery. Nick McKenzie, CEO of Green King, said, "We are proud to have built Old Speckled Hen into one of the nation's favourite ales over the last 25 years and are delighted to have secured a partner in Estrella Dam who will continue to brew the ales in the UK." Pub experts, including Dave Richardson of Oxford Camera, Campaign for Real Ale, are now assessing why Green King decided to sell such a famous brand, having acquired it in 1999 from Moreland, which it closed down the following year. It is still widely available in GK's Oxfordshire pubs and is one of three GK brands in the top 10 cask ales by sales volume in 2025, alongside Abbott and IPA. Green King has now announced a new strategy to concentrate on-trade sales via pubs rather than off-trade via retail or export. It will no longer sell bottled, canned or packaged beers from next June, although Dam will continue to sell Old Speckled Hen this way. Green King's new £40 million brewery in Bury St Edmunds is due to open at the same time. Writing in What's Brewing, Camera's Roger Protz called the move a shock decision, resulting from the rapacious profiteering of giant supermarkets. He added, "Old Speckled Hen is one of Green King's major brands, but the income from sales to the off-trade is tiny as a result of the deep discounts demanded by the retailers." Green King owns a massive estate of 2,600 pubs, restaurants and hotels. It supplies those outlets with draft and packaged beers. Its two main cask brands, IPA and Abbott, are popular in its pubs and also in the wider on-trade, meaning free trade pubs, or those owned by other brewers or pub companies that allow their tenants to sell guest beers. The former Moorland Brewery off Ox Street in Abingdon was converted into flats. The popular Brewery Tap pub in the street is a reminder of the town centre brewery. Abingdon now has a microbrewery, Loose Cannon, which is situated off Drayton Road. Old Speckled Hen beer is named after an MG car, a 1927 black and gold factory runaround.
A new branch of the popular Gales bakery brand is set to open in Oxford, with jobs advertised for the shop. Five locations in Oxfordshire already benefit from the wide array of freshly baked pastries, savoury and sweet treats, bread and coffee served up at Gales, and one more is about to join the list. With a rapid expansion ongoing in more than 180 Gales shops across the UK, the upmarket chain bakery has set its sights on the untapped potential of a new site in Oxfordshire. An announcement advertising new jobs at the site revealed that a Gales bakery will be opening soon at Oxford's Westgate Shopping Centre. A new Gales bakery also opened at Banbury Gateway Retail Park earlier this month. Speaking ahead of the Banbury store's opening, Gales operational manager Bobby Holmes said, "We're so excited to be opening our doors. From fresh baked sourdough and artisan bread to buttery pastries, handcrafted sandwiches, cakes and expertly brewed coffee, everything is prepared with care and baked fresh." Advertising the job of head baker at the new eatery, the statement said, "We're looking for head bakers who have a passion to join the Gales family and for training and developing others. You should be motivated by taking charge and want to be a positive role model. There's no day being the same. You must be organised and clear talking to maximise your team's potential and to deliver our fresh food, bread and cakes to high standards whilst maintaining food safety standards."
A rugby club is celebrating 50 years of community teamwork and grassroots sport. Littlemore Rugby Football Club, Oxford, was founded on the 15th of July 1976, following a meeting organised by Lynn Evans, head of PE at Pierce School, and community administrator Alan Noble. The meeting, held in the school's further education block, brought together around 20 people and set the foundation for the club's growth over the next five decades. Dick Rudman, the club's inaugural captain, led the team to a victory in 10 of their 11 matches during the club's first season. Early post-match gatherings took place at the George Inn, where players fundraised from a small shed behind the pub. With support from head teacher Bob Moon, the club secured a lease and loan from Morell's Brewery, making the clubhouse the first and only licensed premises on school grounds in England. Over the years, the club has achieved notable successes, including County Cup victories against teams such as Oxford and Banbury in the 1980s, and winning the County Plate at Iffley Road in 2004. Littlemore's RFC crest, designed by Jonathan Rawlingson, features a knight's head and is inspired by the area's historical ties to the Knights Templar. The club continues to be led by long-standing members, including President Tim Stevens, Chairman John Perry, former Captain Jason Chambers, and current team captain Jack Massey. Their ethos remains strength through community.
Oxford United beat Aldershot Town 3-1 in their first match under Aaron Ramsey, and the former Arsenal man has already stamped his mark on the team. The Ewes won in their first pre-season friendly in front of their supporters after going a goal down. Idemo Imaku, Getlin Odonka and Jian Jinwu scoring the goals to secure victory at the EBP Stadium. Oxford were hit with a transfer embargo earlier this month, with the club committing to keeping the squad together and the new boss excited to work with the current group. During Tuesday's win, there were some standout aspects that Ramsey had brought to the table. All three goals against the Shots came from the Ewes applying pressure high up the pitch. For their first, midfielder Jamie McDonald harassed the host centre-back, putting in a sweet tackle to set Ruben Roskin on his way before his assist for Imaku. The second came from Odonka positioning himself on the shoulder and pouncing on a goalkeeping error to slide home, before Jinwu nicked the ball away from a defender at the halfway to bear down on goal and neatly chip the keeper. Off the ball, Oxford looked energetic and eager not to give time to opposing defenders. Under Ramsey, it seems as though United are beginning to get used to owning the ball. Goalkeeper Jamie Cumming was noticeably on the ball for slightly longer on Tuesday and tried to prioritise a short ball to Cameron Brannigan. On more than one occasion, the captain and pivot would then find one of the full-backs space and the team would then bring the ball forward and attack down the wings. There were a few early scares with the Shots putting pressure on the keeper, but Oxford quickly grew into this new way of starting from the back. We had seen it in one or two brief cameos under Matt Bloomfield, but South Korean forward Jinwu came on in the number 10 position and offered a new kind of threat. He offered a threat off the ball, and it would be exciting to see the 26-year-old have more of an impact on it. He was unfortunately withdrawn after scoring with just under 20 minutes of play under his belt. In addition, wing-back Ruben Roskin played as a winger. The Dutchman has played higher up the pitch previously, but he was used as a winger from the start and managed an assist for the first Ewes goal. There is some promise there as a winger from Roskin. His physicality could use some work, but he has shown he can be effective higher up the pitch.
Arrogant academics have been slammed as Oxfordshire's King Alfred is found in a car park. Researchers believe that they have identified the long-lost burial site of Alfred the Great, the 9th-century monarch, celebrated as the original King of England, who fought against the Viking invasions. Born in Wantage, he is heavily associated with Oxfordshire, with his birthplace hosting an annual festival in his honour and having a statue of him in its marketplace. Historical researcher Graham Phillips now claims to have located the king's remains after a 13-year investigation, pinpointing a car park in Winchester as the likely burial site, just 20 yards from the scenic garden where Alfred was once thought to have been buried. But after evidence was presented to academics at the University of Winchester archaeology team, the bid to excavate the area and recover the bones was shut down, it has been claimed. Matt Everett of Dragonfly Films, which is behind the revelations, said, "It was the same thing for a long time with the woman who fought to excavate the car park for Richard III. She was someone from outside mainstream academics. Her and Graham are respected researchers in their communities, but they are not academics. That poor lady suffered a lot of ridicule until she was proven right. We don't want the country to make the same mistake here." Mr. Everett claims their request for preliminary ground penetrating radar, GPR, survey and further excavation were dismissed by Winchester University. He said, "They didn't properly look at them or read what I gave them properly. They just said, this leads to a dead end. They could have sent a bunch of students to scan the ground to look at anomalies. It would be minimal effort and little to no hassle with no damage done. But they've just shut it down." He believes academic arrogance is to blame for the lack of engagement. Alfred the Great died in 899 and was originally buried in Winchester Cathedral. His remains were later moved to Hyde Abbey, which was destroyed during the dissolution of the monasteries in 1539. Earlier excavations in 2013 at St Bartholomew's Church in Winchester disproved a long-held belief that bones buried there belonged to Alfred. Mr Phillips's investigation uncovered new documentary evidence suggesting the king's remains were reinterred elsewhere in the late 18th century. The suspected burial location was revealed in a new episode of the British television series Weird Britain, aired on Blaze TV on Wednesday, the 8th of July.
That was the last of our local news items for this week. If you have any comments or feedback about Oxtalk, we now have a new landline number for you to call. The number is 01865 377635. That's 01865 377635. Please leave a message for Michelle, our listener coordinator, or you can call Margaret on 07496 062280. That's 07496 062280, and please remember to leave your name and a contact number with your message, or you can send an email to mail@oxtalk.org.uk. This edition and those from the previous 4 weeks are available on our website. That's www.oxtalk.org.uk, where you can either listen or download the audio file if you wish. So it's goodbye from us. Thank you for listening, and we wish you a peaceful week.
Notice to listeners of Oxtalk who may wish to use an Alexa smart speaker to access our service. To listen to Oxtalk on an Alexa device, you can use the Talking Newspaper skill. You will need to first enable the skill. To do this, simply say, "Alexa, enable Talking Newspaper." Then, to listen to Oxtalk, please follow this procedure. Alexa, open Talking Newspaper.
Welcome to your Talking Newspaper skill. Please say the name of a newspaper or a town or city you would like to hear from.
Oxford.
Here are the following newspapers nearest to Oxford. Please pick a newspaper name. Oxford and District Talking News, Whitney Talking News Latest Edition, Whitney Talking News Previous Edition, Whitney Talking Magazine, Wallingford, and District Talking Newspaper. Or do you want to hear more?
Oxford and District Talking News.
Do you want to listen to Oxford and District Talking News?
Yes.
This is Oxford and District Talking News.
If you have any problems listening to Oxtalk using an Alexa device, it could be due to the way that your device is set up. Please check the settings with whoever set it up in the first place. If you still have problems, please contact Oxtalk and we will try to help.